Ben Herbert has been attending the UU since moving to Winona in 2021 with his wife and Gwendolyn and his daughter Lily, and he has spent the majority of his career working in and around human spaceflight industry. And he has deep extracurricular interests in stoicism, mindfulness, and the intersection of the two. He's a trained unified mindfulness guide and a founder of the Winona Stoa. This is a monthly gathering of folks who have a mission to bring together like-minded individuals in Winona across age, gender, and contemplative traditions to talk about stoicism. Welcome, Ben.
Morning. You guys hear me? Okay. Thanks for having me. I would say my intent for doing this talk was to give you a bit of a taste of what stoicism is. Enough for you to decide if you find it valuable or compelling enough to dig into further. If not necessarily to be a stoic, but maybe just to realize the importance of defining your own philosophy of life. I personally came to stoicism only about a year and a half ago, and it hasn't really been that long. And as is often the case, I found it while I was trying to get through a pretty challenging time in my life. I had a career dissatisfaction, some interpersonal strife in my life, you know, the general midlife crisis that I tend to talk about when I put shells in waters, all while being the parent of a small child whose own journey of emotional development so often held up a mirror to my own soul. I came to Stoicism looking for direction, for an operating system for life beyond my conditioning from a challenging childhood. And since starting this journey, I've found that Stoicism has improved my emotional regulation, it has reduced my anxiety, it has increased my sense of fulfillment, it's promoted my presence, and it's supported my sense of agency in the world. That's not to say that Stoicism is a panacea. It requires you to have access to your rational faculty. And if you remember a few weeks ago, we had a talk about polyvagal theory. We may find ourselves not, you know, having access to that rational faculty necessarily as frequently as we want. But through consistent practice of Stoicism, we can help enforce those mental circuits in our brain needed to keep you there more often. So before we get into Stoicism itself, I wanted to give you a little bit of a historical context to know where this all came from. Stoicism is a Hellenistic philosophy, which means that it started in ancient Greece, and its philosophical roots go all the way back to Socrates. Socrates is sort of the grandfather of Stoicism, even though Stoicism is downstream of him. The school itself was founded a bit later, after Socrates had already died, by Zeno of Citium. Zeno was a merchant, and once he had a vessel that was full of this precious cargo, very expensive stuff called royal purple. It's a dye that's sort of laboriously harvested from shellfish, lots of little baby shellfish. but that's what they used to dye the robes of the royalty and the affluent. But his ship sank, and his cargo was completely lost. He was completely destitute, forlorn, and he found his way to Athens, and he was unable to cope with this circumstance. So he was looking for something. He was searching for direction. So he started to study philosophy, and he eventually started to develop the ideas of Stoicism downstream of the philosophy of cynicism. The name Stoicism actually comes from the Stoa Poikile, which is translates to the painted porch, a colonnade under which he would teach to the public. So that's where the name came from. Very few Stoic writings have survived the onslaught of time. Stoicism comes to us primarily by means of the writings of Seneca the Younger, who was a wealthy Roman statesman. You can see his picture on the top next to Socrates up there. Epictetus, he's on the bottom after Seneca. He was a former slave, actually, who then got his freedom and became a philosopher. And his teachings were written down by his student Arrian. And Marcus Aurelius, the last picture there at the top, who was the emperor of Rome, the philosopher emperor of Rome, who had a journal that he kept. It was never meant for publication, but it turned out to be one of the, you know, best pieces of writing that has been created in my mind. The teachings have survived through time, through war, through purging through when Christianity came to prevalence, because enough people found them valuable at the right points in history to keep them safe and to propagate them. And today, Stoicism has enjoyed an international resurgence. It's been spearheaded by a movement called Modern Stoicism and popular authors like Ryan Holiday. So what is Stoicism? First, we're going to start with Stoicism is not, because with popularity has come a lot of misinterpretation. So the first, and this is a common one, and this is a trick of English, Stoicism, lowercase s, is not the same as Stoicism, capital S. The colloquial English word stoic means emotionally cold or someone with a stiff upper lip. Capital S stoic is someone who follows the philosophy of Stoicism, which instead advocates for the opposite of emotional suppression. It calls for us to be quite aware of and engaged with our emotions. Next up is Broicism, which is one of those fun online terms that has started. Stoicism is simply not a philosophy of toxic masculinity or rugged individualism, despite what it says on TikTok, and is sometimes misinterpreted by the manosphere online. As we will see, it stresses the importance of taking ownership of those things that are truly yours, your judgments, your reaction, your actions in the world, but only as a means of promoting a flourishing human community in which we all have important roles to play. Nor is the philosophy intended only for men, despite some historical translations that might lead you to think otherwise. It provides a guide to being human, a rational, moral being in an interconnected community of other beings, regardless of those things that separate us into categories like gender, race, or nationality. Stoicism with a dollar sign instead of an S is another misinterpretation. Stoicism is not intended to be a life hack to achieving wealth or fame or power. And in fact, that's sort of counter to the entire idea of the philosophy. A Stoic may prove to be successful in life, but their happiness is not rooted in success. Success is not the point. And as we will see, the aim of the Stoic is the internal reward of living a life of virtue, not any external, often fleeting reward. And finally, Stoicism, despite being an ism, is not dogmatic. It's not a dogmatic ism. Stoicism is a cognitive framework. It's a thought process to serve as the bumper lane to the bowling balls that are our thoughts. It points us towards a destination which we know we'll never actually achieve, but we should never try to stop trying to get to. So with that cleared up, we'll get into what Stoicism actually is. We'll explain this from the ground up. So the foundation of Stoicism, of the philosophy as a whole, sits on the idea that humans are unique from all other beings in two primary ways. One is we have the distinctive ability for reflective reason. That is, we have agency of thought, and we have the ability to examine our judgments before taking action. That's not to say that other creatures can't reason at all. There are varying degrees of that. But this is far and away a distinguishing quality of being human, of our innate consciousness. And two, we are distinctively pro-social. We need each other to thrive, to form tribes and communities and cities and governments. And this is not to say that other creatures don't have social tendencies, but humans sort of take this to the next level. Our well-being, physical and emotional, and indeed our survival, depends on human connection and being part of a group. So an excellent human does these two things well. And this excellence is called arete in Greek. And it's most often translated into English as virtue, which is a word that comes with some baggage through different religious traditions. So we'll clarify what we mean by that word going forward here. Generally, though, virtue is our roadmap to doing those two things that I mentioned well. So here are the virtues. These are the four cardinal virtues. And they all have various sub-virtues to help you understand kind of what I mean. But the broad categories are wisdom, or effectively good sense, knowing what action to take in the world. Justice, treating other people as they should be treated. Temperance or moderation. This is the middle way of Buddhism, the golden mean of Aristotle. And courage, when you know the right thing to do, having the courage to actually do it. You might recognize the similarities to the four cardinal directions on the compass rose, and this is not an accident. Virtue is a type of knowledge that provides a map to making appropriate decisions in life. According to the Stoics, living according to nature. It points us in the direction of happiness and fulfillment, to what the Greeks call eudaimonia, or flourishing. The word happiness also has sort of a lot of baggage associated with it, too, historically. I tend to prefer the word flourishing. Virtue does not, however, provide objective direction to us. It's not dogmatic, like what I was saying. Virtue provides us a framework, a thought process to go through, a question to ask yourself, is this virtuous? A call to define the specifics for yourself. The Stoics said that there are no sages, which means there's no one with perfect moral knowledge, a perfect understanding of virtue. Learning and applying virtue is the task of life, and a task that we'll never complete with perfection, but that we should always keep trying to do. And here is the core claim of Stoicism. This is where Stoicism starts becoming unique. Virtue is the only good, according to Stoicism. And let me say that differently. To be just, to be temperate, to be courageous, to be wise, is both necessary and sufficient for happiness or flourishing in all circumstances. So instead of tying your happiness to external conditions like wealth, fame, power, health, virtue is its own reward. And unlike those external conditions, it's a reward that can never be taken from you because it's internal to you. Your character is the only thing that's truly yours, the only thing that's ultimately in your control. And this realization is called the dichotomy of control. It's the key insight of Stoicism, the key piece of wisdom that it offers to us. It's best embodied by the opening lines of Epictetus' handbook called the Enchiridion. I'm going to read this verbatim because I think it's important. Some things are within our power, while others are not. Within our power are opinion, motivation, desire, aversion, and in a word, whatever is our own doing. Not within our power are our body, property, reputation, office, in a word, whatever is not in our own doing. So recognizing this, to me, is remarkably powerful. It's empowering. You always have agency. You only need to use it and apply it to the right things. Now, this does not imply that living a life of virtue will always be pleasant. There is a distinction between living well and living pleasantly. One may live in unpleasant conditions well, but one may also live poorly in pleasant conditions. This also isn't to say that you might not prefer pleasantness to unpleasantness. It's natural to prefer wealth to poverty or to prefer health to sickness. And Stoicism opens the door for you to pursue these things, but with a light touch. If pursuit of something external does not interfere or conflict with your pursuit of virtue, then by all means, go ahead and pursue it. But one must not be attached to the outcome of that pursuit. One must never tie one's happiness to achieving it. The Stoics call these preferred indifference. You may prefer them, but ultimately, you need to remain indifferent to them, or your happiness rests on a house of cards. Now, this is key, though. Indifference to externals does not necessarily mean lack of concern for them, only freedom from enslavement from them. It's a recognition that these things ultimately are not in your control, even if they are within your influence. So this is a personal benefit to how you live, but living with virtue also benefits the collective whole. Core to the idea of Stoic ethics is how we interact with others, how we play our lives or play our roles within our families or communities and as citizens of the universe as a whole, and how to do so with excellence. The Stoics taught that we are part of a great cosmopolis, a community of rational beings living in relationship with nature. We are interconnected. To use the Buddhist phrase, we inter-be with each other. None of us exists in isolation, and at the end of the day, we flourish when we all flourish. And for this reason, Stoics often answer a call to service in politics and leadership and social justice movements. Stoics can use wise action to promote virtue in the world, while still understanding that ultimately the only virtue they control is their own, and they must respond to vice in the world in a way that does not harm their character. Now, living virtuously can be extremely difficult, as it turns out. Our thoughts are too often on autopilot. Our emotions are too often indulged. Epictetus said the following: it's not events that disturb us, but our judgments about that. So sit with that for a second. What often amplifies our suffering is not the event itself, but the judgment we attach to it. So if we can have better, healthier, more correct judgments, if we have the discipline necessary to wisely assent to or reject what pops into our heads, our suffering will decrease and virtue will be more accessible. The Stoics realized that challenging our judgment takes work. It must be practiced continuously, and so developed a series of cognitive reframings, tools, and practices to help us do just that. So I'm going to describe two of the most well-known practices for the sake of time, but there are a host of others, and they served as the inspiration for cognitive behavioral therapy back in the 60s. So the first one, amor fati, this is one of the ones we read in Latin. Amor fati means love your fate. So this is a practice of loving your fate. Stoicism, though, is not fatalistic, but it does emphasize that much of what occurs in life is a result of a great causal chain of events in the universe, and ultimately, out of your control. Loving your fate means to accept those things that have occurred, accept the present moment just as it is, and choose the next wise action from that perspective, not one anchored in the past, dissatisfied with the present, or fearful of the future. After all, the past no longer exists, the future has not yet arrived. All you have is what is here right now, regardless of how it came to be. If you're angry that it's raining at your picnic, for example, you're rejecting a reality that you've judged to be bad. But this has no effect on that reality. It only leads to you getting wet and being upset and angry and suffering. So instead, you can choose to make best of a situation. You can find a tree to hide under, you could laugh it off. This can be best understood more broadly by way of analogy, and this is a common Stoic analogy that you hear talked about a lot. Imagine a dog chained to a heavy cart that's being driven down the street. The dog can't affect where the cart is going. It can't affect how fast it's going or where it goes. It can be dragged down the street by the cart, or it can choose to walk comfortably alongside of it. Either way, it's going where the cart is going, but it's not suffering if it keeps some slack in the chain. The next one is memento mori. A memento mori means, effectively, remember that you will die. This is a practice of contemplating your mortality. It's not a morbid exercise. And you'll find this practice in other traditions as well, different elements of Tibetan Buddhism, for instance. It's not a morbid exercise, but rather one of accepting the reality of impermanence. The Stoics taught that everything you have is on loan from the universe, which I find to be a pretty good framing. Everything is on loan. Your stuff, your loved ones, and especially your life itself. And while it can be uncomfortable, developing a relationship with the idea of death provides perspective. It helps emphasize those things that are truly important. It helps de-emphasize those things that are not. And it also helps us stop living in fear of death as something that we've judged to be bad, when it just is. Rather, we can live life with gratitude for having been alive at all, knowing that all things must end, entropy always wins, and death is not a fate uniquely bestowed upon you. Socrates famously said that philosophy is nothing more than practicing for death. So personally, to kind of practice this, I often take walks through Woodlawn Cemetery to contemplate what it means to be mortal, and I look at those crumbling headstones whose names you can no longer read, the effort that someone once made to leave a lasting mark. And I remember that I too will fade from memory. And strangely, this realization doesn't feel depressing. It makes the trees seem more beautiful, the breeze sweeter, the simple act of walking more precious and worth paying attention to. There's so much more that can be said. This is a short talk, so I will wrap it up here. But I personally still have a lot of work to do. I've been doing this for about a year and a half. It takes a lot of practice to change the entrenched patterns in your brain. But I have found, even in that time, that Stoicism has genuinely improved my life. It has affected the color of my cognition for the better. I personally couple Stoic practice with the practice of a Buddhist-style meditation or mindfulness meditation, because I find the two to be both complementary and reinforcing. I'll leave you with one of my favorite Stoic quotes from Marcus Aurelius. This relates back to the children's story that we heard earlier about what to do with a problem. The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. The Stoics don't provide us control over life. They help us meet life well. And sometimes the very things we wish away are the things that shape our character, the things that give us the opportunity to choose virtue over vice. If you have any interest in learning more about Stoicism, I started a group in town called the Winona Stoa to help just with that. Anyone is welcome to attend. We meet monthly. Usually it's on the third Sunday of the month. And we do deep dives in various Stoic relevant topics, and we especially explore the intersection between Stoicism and mindfulness. Our next meeting is Sunday, March 22nd. We'll be discussing Stoic cosmopolitanism, the circles of Heracles, oikiosis, and Stoic compassion. So if you want to know what those are, come to the meeting. You can send an email to the email address up on the screen. I've also put a poster in the back of the whiteboard back there if you want to. It'll be there in perpetuity. So if this is not your week, maybe next week. Right now we're meeting at the at Blooming Grounds. I purposely didn't put the location because I'm trying to find a different location because we have had a remarkably good attendance. I've been so impressed. We've got like 24, 25 people on the email list. We get anywhere between 12 and 20 people showing up every Sunday we have it. We have great discussions. We've done some joint group meditating. I've been really impressed with the quality of the conversation and the sustained interest in it. So with that, I'd welcome any questions you have.
Category.
Sure. I'd say right now we probably lean towards more white hair. In fact, a lot of UUs, several UUs come, but we've got a pretty good range. We've got, I think, on the low end, probably early to mid-20s. We've got a couple, peer middle-aged dads. Again, it tends to be a response to, midlife crises. Emily comes sometimes. So we've got a pretty broad range of attendance, which has been nice. And I hope as we grow, I just gave a talk at Riverway about space, which was pretty fun. And I was like, well, I should talk about other things. So maybe one day I'll give a talk about Stoicism or do a nerd night or something and try to grow the community. I personally wish that I had learned this earlier, and I wish I hadn't come to it through strife. I wish I had been taught it in high school or that it was required in undergrad. For me, philosophy in undergrad was like this thing. I was like, oh, that's the philosophy majors, and just what a waste of time. Like, I'm engineering and I'm getting a job. But that set me up for failure. And I wish that I had learned earlier how to think through life that way.
Ben, can you give us an example of a time when you felt some strong emotions coming up and you put to good use maybe an awareness of what you can control, what you can't control,
sure,
or something like that?
Let me try to think of a good example. I'll speak broadly about it first. One thing I come back to a lot is Seneca said that anger can be a big problem for all of us, right? Seneca said that anger is a form of temporary insanity. And kind of keeping that in the back of your mind can be helpful. Coupled with mindfulness, you can start to see those things that happen in your brain that you have no control over. We don't know where our thoughts come from. It's conditioning and reinforced circuitry and such, right? You'll get a thought that pops into your head. And I like to think about when I see that thought, I can see it more clearly through practice of mindfulness because I know what it feels like in my body. I can not identify it. I can see it not as I am angry, but maybe Ben is angry or anger is being experienced. And that subtle shift in pronoun helps a lot. And once you can do that, you can separate from it, and then you can start to remember to do the Stoic practice, which is, okay, anger is often, according to the Stoics, a secondary emotion. It is a response to something else. For me, I've discovered anger is typically a response, downstream response to anxiety. I'm anxious about something, and I feel like someone is preventing me from preventing something bad in the future, and that makes me angry. But if you can explore that judgment, identify it, you can start to short-circuit it, provided that you don't completely identify with the anger as yours. And I started to think about this as a form of temperance. It feels good to feel bad in a weird way, if that makes sense. Like, when you're angry, like, it's really comfortable to sit there and just be angry. Like, you just want to stay there. It is a low potential energy point, to use a physics phrase, where you just want to sit. And to me, that's a form of temperance. If I cannot indulge in that and instead try to rise above, that framing helps me. So I can't think of a specific example off the top of my head right now, but generally that's what I try to apply. And I'm 10% successful.
Thank you for the presentation, Ben. It's amazing to have such a complex philosophy distilled into a concise presentation like this. Stoicism, the way you present it, reminds me of Zen or Taoism, in that it delights in these epigrammic instructions. And one that puzzled me, and I was wondering if you could expand on it, was when you showed the differentiation between things you can control and things you can't control. The first of the latter was the body. And I know that we don't give birth to ourselves, our bodies are provided and we inhabit them, but surely we have a bit of control and an obligation to care for our bodies. So how does Stoicism thread that needle?
Sure. So I guess there's a difference between outright control and agency and influence. So the thing, with respect to our body, we can choose to, I'm gonna take steps to eat well, to exercise. Maybe I know that I can practice virtue better if my body is available to me, right? So the steps I can take, the controls I can have, are the decisions I make on what I put into my body, the exercise I take. What I can't control, though, is the outcome of that. Like, I could eat all the right things, I could do all the right exercise, I could still break my leg on the way out the door today. I still, could have some health thing happen that I have no control over, that has been a time bomb in my body for forever, You have no idea. There's so much that you can't actually control the outcome. You can only control what you choose to do. And so that comes back to the idea of, there's a typical misinterpretation of Stoicism that if everything is indifferent and you don't have control over things, then why even try, right? And it sort of misses the point that the point is to try. That is the point. Take your next best, wisest action, knowing what you know now. Keep a light touch on the future. Don't be attached to an outcome. Look towards the future so that it can guide the steps you want to take in life. But don't be attached to the future being a certain way, your body being healthy or what have you.
Thanks, Ben. As you pointed out, Stoicism is really a product of the Hellenistic world, ancient Greek and Roman. So what do you think has kept Stoicism alive through 2,000 years of a predominantly Christian theology that in some ways is quite different from Stoicism? I mean, Marcus Aurelius really hasn't been out of print for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
But it continues to still inspire people. But I'm curious, what aspects of it do you think have allowed it to survive for so long?
So there are a couple of logistical answers to this. One is the fact that Marcus Aurelius was an emperor, and so his works, and Seneca was a high up statesman, right? So their works had a historical pressure for preservation. I found out recently that the works of Epictetus, at one point, if you go through you dissect the translations, came down to a single copy at one point that was saved when Constantinople fell. It got put on a boat to get taken to Europe somewhere to be saved. And the interesting thing is that the early Christians, not every early Christian, but there were early Christians who found a lot of value in Stoic philosophy and found intersection in Stoicism to early Christianity philosophy. Stoicism, I don't find to be unique. It's a different framing of a lot of the same ideas. Like, to me, Buddhism and Stoicism are 80% the same thing. A lot of aspects of early Christianity are 60-70% the same thing. And so when the right people at the right time in history found these valuable, they copied them down, they treasured them, and then they started propagating. Once you get the printing press happened in the 1500s, or when the first Stoic text started being propagated, thinkers started finding it. Thomas Jefferson had a copy of Epictetus, you know, and as did many of the founding fathers. I think enough people at the right point in history, even with the prevailing Christian domination, found that the thinking philosophically through Stoicism, the religion aspect aside, was still very valuable. And they may have found that it helped them practice their religion better. The two are not mutually exclusive necessarily. So,
this will be our last question in the whole group, but I'm sure Ben will stay for questions after the close of the service.
And you have my email, so if anyone wants to email, you're welcome to do that too.
Thanks so much for the talk, great talk. I wonder if you have a take on, my impression of Stoicism is that it's very masculine, like a lot of the adherents are anyway, and you've talked about the toxic masculinity tie-in and the middle-aged dad cohort that you have. Do you have a take on why that is, and what do you think people tying it to toxic masculinity get wrong about it? And do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure, yeah. I think it's largely an accident of history. So you've got two things working against you. One, you have the cultural times of the, you know, 3rd, 4th, 2nd, 1st century BCE, right, where the role of women was very different than in our modern society. And then you also have the fact that we are reading English translated largely by Christians, you know, in the 1800s. And even today, some of the more modern translations are still seen a little bit through that lens. You'll find a lot of translations that speak to, you know, God in a way that the Stoics never really intended. And the same is true of the way they translate pronouns. There are writings, I'm trying to remember exactly, Musonius Rufus in particular, I think. I could be misremembering that. But there are writings specifically where Stoics specifically said, this philosophy is accessible to women as it is to men. It is accessible to a slave as it is to a Roman statesman or to an emperor, right? The whole idea is to how to be human well. And you know, there were some, in modern lenses, unvirtuous views of women in that sense going back 2,500 years. But you know, there were women philosophers in ancient Rome too, or ancient Greece too. I mean, one of the philosophers taught Socrates a thing or two. I'm forgetting her name at the moment, but about the nature of love and such. So I think a lot of what you see is a historical consequence, but the intent of the philosophy extrapolated to modern times is that it applies to every human equally, regardless of race, gender, nationality, everything else. Now, that is to say, though, sorry, that there are people online who have taken these translations and it's like, oh, it says he, it means me, it means men. Like, so there is a, and that's where Broicism comes in. And, you know, it's tied into the same mindsets that, you know, affected the last election, right? Where you get this disaffected young men in the context of a changing society grasping on something to make them feel like they have control. And ironically, they grasp on something that tells them they don't have control.